This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Alon Hope always stood out academically. She went to gifted and talented schools and tested into STEM-focused magnet school in Prince George's County, Maryland, where she grew up, one of the wealthiest majority black counties in the country. Alon was on track to be an engineer, but in her freshman year of college, she realized she wanted to do something different. She changed her major to psychology, in part because of a question sparked by her own upbringing. Some of her high school classmates were doing quite well at Ivy League schools, but others were struggling to hold down a minimum wage job. And these were the same students who sat next to her in high-level classes at her rigorous high school. So what was going on? That's the question that drove Alon's research and her career in education and psychology. Today, she's a professor in the Department of Psychology at North Carolina State University. She studies black youth and activism, academic achievement, and racial identity. Alon Hope, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
It's good to have you. So talk about those days growing up in Prince George's County. You're probably going to school while I was working in the D.C. area. So I get the idea because that's right around Washington, D.C. Right?
Yeah. So Prince George's County is a suburb of D.C., probably 5 minutes from the D.C. borders where I grew up in Hyattsville, Maryland. Went to elementary schools and middle and high school all in Prince George's County. And it was a great time.
Gifted and talented programs right off the bat. So talk about that and your sense of who you were, right, and living in your community growing up in, as you were going to school.
Yeah, so in the schools that I went to, they were majority black public schools, and it's a lot of other suburbs in the D.C. area, most of which are majority white suburbs, a little more affluent. But in my school, it was just a lot of different kinds of kids, a lot of different kinds of black kids from African-American, Caribbean backgrounds, African backgrounds. And we were all in class together. And some of us were in kind of the gifted and talented classes. Some were in kind of, I guess, what would be considered the regular classes. And all in school, all trying to do well, trying to learn, and just kids. Mostly having fun.
Did you like school?
I did. I like to go to school. I like to learn. When I was younger, I did this summer camp where we kind of got to do extra math. So I was that kid.
You got to do extra math.
Yeah. Who in the second grade was very excited to go to camp to do math all summer. And was very frustrated when I could only get up to long division in the second grade and would stay up all night at the kitchen table trying to do long division in the second grade.
And so talk about your parents. Your father was an attorney?
Yeah, my father's an attorney in College Park, Maryland. He has a small practice there. He's probably one of the smartest people I know. And he kept us on our toes. We, you know, with an attorney father, you learn how to argue really, really quickly to make your point and to raise objections.
And critical thinking skills. It's not just taking on board the information, but learning how to evaluate and assess what you're being told.
To try to make your point and take in the information and to take counterpoints. And it's kind of mini debate prep, I guess.
So what was the message at home from you, him and your mom about education in school?
Oh, it was always a given. They met at Indiana University in college, and education was always a top priority in our household. So my mother actually went back to school when I was in, I guess, later elementary school or middle school. She went for her master's degree. She's a marriage and family therapist. So I got to see firsthand graduate education. Had to go to a couple of classes sometimes and sit in the back and be quiet when she didn't have child care for us. And got to see her take the GREs. I remember helping her study flashcards for the GRE for her to go back to school. So education was always important.
And important for you, as we said, you went into special programs for gifted and talented, some really cool programs. But at one point, you realize, I'm in this program. It's got quite a luster attached to it. And yet, we don't have a social studies teacher.
Yeah. So, you know, the schools face a lot of challenges. And one is retaining good teachers. And so, I guess it might have been about fourth or fifth grade, maybe fifth grade, we didn't have a social studies teacher for a little bit of time at school. So I told my mother that we were watching just movies in class every day, which, you know, in the 90s, you get really excited. They roll out that big TV with the VCR player, and you know it's a movie day. Mm-hmm. But after about the fifth or sixth movie day, you're kind of wondering what you're going to learn. So my mother said, well, they got a video player. Take this Eyes on the Prize civil rights documentary to social studies. That's your curriculum. Y'all are going to learn about
the
civil
rights. Did they do
that? Yeah, we watched the Eyes on the Prize series.
That's good. And you're talking about, you talked about learning other things too, integrated curriculum. Was that in elementary school where you took your, you know, everything you were learning from class to class and it became kind of a
portfolio?
Yeah,
we had this amazing teacher who came in and brought this idea of feasts. And so we would learn about 1 year the Middle Ages and the next year ancient Egypt. And we would do it in language arts class, in social studies class, sometimes in math. And we would learn about what it was like to be a royal in those times and also what it was like to be in the servant class of those times. And we would have a feast at the end of the year to accumulate all of our knowledge. And in the morning, half of us would be royals and half of us would be servants. And in the afternoon, we would switch. So we all got a chance at each role.
So you're getting a subtle and a subversive lessons in social justice and all of this.
Oh, yeah, and class dynamics and history.
Yep. Although maybe not. I think social justice, because I'm assuming you'd come out of this saying, I never want to treat anybody that way. But I suppose the opposite is true. You say, you know what? I want to always be the upper class.
Yeah, it was kind of clear that you did not want to always
come out of school like that.
Yeah, you didn't always want to be cleaning up after everybody. But also that, you know, there's a lot of roles in society.
Well, what was your sense of it all? I mean, you talked about, you know, sort of developing critical judgment, your mom realizing that if you're going to watch films, you should watch something that's got some content. What was your sense at the time of being involved in such a rich academic environment and yet lacking social studies? I mean, from your vantage point now, you might say, well, what's going on with that school district? I wonder if you felt that at the time.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I went to school about 30 minutes from my house. I didn't go to my neighborhood schools. And so the idea was that I was going to a school that was better, and to still see that that school had particular gaps. It was something that I noticed at the time, but kind of felt confident that perhaps I was still getting the education that I needed overall. There was, from elementary school, we were told, in Prince George's County, if you want to go to college, you need to go to Eleanor Roosevelt High School. So you need to do well in elementary school so you can go to a particular middle school to go to Eleanor Roosevelt. And so that was kind of the message that we all got.
You took it on board because that's where you went, right?
Yep. Straight through.
So talk about Eleanor Roosevelt High School. What's there and why is that so special?
So Roosevelt was a science and tech school. So at the time when I was in elementary school, there was just two in the county, Oxon Hill and Roosevelt. So Oxon Hill serviced the southern part of the county and Roosevelt serviced the northern part of the county. By the time I got to high school, they had built a third for the middle part of the county. And the idea was you get to take all of these extra kind of AP classes, more rigorous kind of offerings, particularly in math and science, that would behoove you to getting into college and university.
And you, who enjoyed math camp in second grade.
Yeah.
We're on your way to become an engineer.
Yeah. People told me you like math, you're good at it, you should be an engineer. You're black, you're a woman, you'll make all the money, go be an engineer.
But beyond all that, you seem to like at least part of it, the math part.
Yeah.
Was that something you were genuinely interested in?
Oh, yeah. I took, I think, pre-calculus over the summer 1 year in high school so I could take AP calculus early so that my senior year we took, a group of us took Calc 3 and differential equations our senior year. We weren't very good at it because it was very rigorous, but we tried and we got our feet wet in more advanced mathematics. I do to this day still enjoy math. And
you were, again, you were on your way. You were thinking about becoming an engineer.
Yep.
Do you have any schools, colleges in mind at that point?
At that point, the big program in the area that everyone kind of aspired to was the Meyerhoff program at UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Mm-hmm. They trained a lot of engineers and were noted for people going off to get their PhDs in grad school, great scholarships. And other than that, I was just looking for programs that had rigorous kind of engineering. Mm-hmm.
So you ended up, though, going to Smith College. Talk about that decision.
I did. So when we were at the college admissions kind of phase, my mom said, okay, you're going to apply where you want, but I'm going to choose one and let your dad choose one. And apply as if you actually want to go there. So I said, okay, fine. If you'll leave me alone, I'll apply to where you want and one where dad wants. As if I actually, I'll do the essays with rigor.
Yeah.
And so my mom chose Smith. And at the time, they were just starting their engineering program. And to my knowledge, the only all-women school with an engineering program, a liberal arts school with an engineering program. And so she thought, you're going into engineering as a Black woman to be around at least women and a more diverse, probably, set of women might behoove you in your education. So she was right. Mom, you were right. And I visited Smith. I applied and I loved it. All the other schools we visited, they, you know, would march out their engineering students with pride and it'd be all white men. So I'm sitting as a Black girl from Prince George's County who's never been in a majority white school, always had Black men, boys and girls in my classes, students of other races and ethnicities. White students were not the majority ever in my education. To sit and see no one of color and no women, and that's the best you could offer on your visiting day,
right.
I thought,
right.
Well, this might not be the place for me.
So you went to Smith College, and we'll find out what happened after that when my conversation with Alon Hope continues. She's a professor in the Department of Psychology at North Carolina State University, and our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Alon Hope, who went to talented and gifted schools, wanted to be an engineer, very good in math, got excited about going to summer camp for math in second grade, and then changed her career path in college. Still likes to solve problems, however. Today, she is a professor in the Department of Psychology at North Carolina State University. Her research is focused on Black youth and activism, academic achievement, and racial identity. So we're talking about going to Smith College now. And again, the idea is you're going to become an engineer. What changed for you? How did that change?
So when I got to Smith, it was a new world. You know, it's in Western Massachusetts, so kind of rural, a lot of big college towns. Mm. And I had honestly never seen so many different types of white people. There was a new diversity for me. And in the engineering program was pretty rigorous because we also still had to do the liberal arts requirements. And so I started off taking intense engineering physics classes and was honestly miserable. I said, you know, I can do this. It's hard. But if I'm going to do something hard, I should like it a little bit more than this. And I don't think the allure of the potential jobs and the potential earning of an engineer is enough for me to persist with this three more years. And it's just going to get harder. So back then we had course catalogs. They were actual paper. And I flipped through the course catalog to see what my other options were. And I looked at education and I thought, okay, perhaps, but I really don't think I'm the one that needs to be in the classroom, but maybe education. And I looked at economics and I said, well, everybody who's in micro and macro econ doesn't seem to be having any much more fun than I am in engineering.
They are. They just don't show it the same way.
Yes, they did not show it. And then I came across psychology and I looked at the course offerings and I said, this sounds interesting, the study of the human mind, human behavior. So I went and talked to a professor, Fletcher Blanchard, and I said, I'm in engineering, but I think I need to be in psychology. And he said, well, what do you know? I am a psychologist in a family all of engineers. And so we talked about what psychology actually means, what the classes mean. And I switched right away. I dropped all my engineering courses the next semester and picked up all psychology courses.
Now, did he try to make the connection between engineering and psychology, the idea that you're in a way sort of trying to solve these riddles and how the pieces fit together? And,
exactly. That, you know, in psychology, there's the clinical side that a lot of people are familiar with, but a big part of psychology is the research side. And so answering the why questions. Yeah. Why do people behave in particular ways under different circumstances? What are the connections? And coming from engineering, I said, these are the kinds of problems I would love to solve.
Well, and I know that the behavioral side is the juicy side, right? Whether it's clinical or research, it's like, well, answer the question why. But also, it would seem to me, you've got to design the study. And it's really hard to do when you're just not going to measure 40 pounds of steam pressure coming out the valve, right? It's much harder to design a study about human behavior.
Oh, yeah. You know, what questions can we ask to actually get at any particular construct? You know, racial identity is one that I study very often. So what does that even mean? Right. What does it mean to be a member of a particular race? And how does that differ across people? And how do we know what we're measuring? Yeah, so there's a lot involved.
And that question also began to sort of knock at your door as well, at the same time that you're asking yourself, what kind of career do I really want? Talk about the questions that you began asking yourself about your fellow students from Roosevelt.
Yeah, so at Smith, I took a research methods course to learn those basics. And my research methods professor said, I think you're really good at this. You should take this advanced research methods class. And so I said, all right, I'll go for it. And then I took advanced research methods and I started to ask questions. And so my question in that class was about standardized testing. And so how do women understand and think about the stereotypes associated with women being good in math? And how does that affect their grades and their standardized test scores? And that all stemmed from my experiences in school, you know, looking around and seeing different students. Some got the Calc 3 differential equations course. Some barely got out of high school with pre-calculus. And so what are some of those differences? And at the time, really thinking about stereotypes, you know, how does that affect how you think about yourself as a learner.
Do you know, can you think now, or were you thinking at the time about maybe some of the implicit biases that may have been built into the education system that may have discouraged women? Because we're hearing a little bit of that we're trying to figure out, why women had not been engaged in those fields for so long, and implicit bias steering women away seemed to be a big part of it.
Yeah, and honestly, I think it's the explicit biases, You know, there's a whole field about implicit bias, but to me, the bigger markers are when teachers say, I know who's going to go to Roosevelt and I know who's not, and we're in the fourth grade. You know, well, that happened to me in my science class. And so to certain students, that signals to them, well, maybe that's not for me. Hmm. But you're in the fourth grade, you're 9 years old. What do you mean it's not for you? You have how much life ahead of you?
Right. And what is it that I've done or haven't done that could possibly indicate my aptitude in this?
Exactly. Yeah. And so to me, it was really the explicit messages. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I started measuring was, what are the messages that students know exist about who they are, gender, race, class, and what they're expected to do? And how does that impact them?
What did you find?
Well, that first study was really correlational. And gosh, I'll have to pull back into my memory banks. That was the very first one.
But you did
find
a correlation.
Yeah. And essentially, the more stereotypes that were known about it was negatively related to doing well.
How much of it, too, because I know for a long time the criticism of standardized tests was that the questions themselves, the assumptions in the test, the language, the vocabulary, assumed a certain background and a certain, kind of upbringing.
Yeah.
And was that any part of your research at that point, or were you just looking at those are all important aspects of why people continue?
Yeah, so that wasn't a part of my research at the time. But since I have read a number of studies, and even one just came out about physics and how the GRE physics subject test doesn't predict, success in graduate school. And part of the critique of the test is that it is not, what is it measuring? Is it measuring class? and certain educational upbringings, or is it measuring actual aptitude and ability to complete particular tasks?
Yeah, and here is where you get to the reason all of this is important, finding out what kinds of biases are in the test, finding out what kind of biases are in the system to deliver the kinds of outcomes we're getting. It was an engineer who told me that every system is perfectly designed to give you the results you're getting.
Yep. Exactly. If you think about it, right, our country was built in such a way to prioritize and privilege particular groups and to marginalize and oppress other groups for the benefit of the majority group. And so if you think about our school system, it was built the same way. And so we have to think, you know, we're repurposing constantly, repurposing tests, just trying to chip away and fix things that are implicitly and explicitly right. designed for certain groups, and particularly white people, to excel. You know, black people weren't considered people
right.
at the advent of a lot of these things. But to continue to just mold what exists, well, how much progress can we actually make in that way?
You also were faced with another question at some point along the line. You did that initial research project on bias and the way that the standardized test affects women. Then you began to think about your fellow classmates at Roosevelt and how they were doing, and that question nagged you.
Yeah, so that kind of, so the rest of my time at Smith, I got a lot of skills through a research lab that focused on alcohol. And so we researched drinking games.
This was not research. Come on. call this research.
It was research. We researched drinking games. And so I got a lot of skills for the research methods in that way. But I still had these education-based questions. And so when I was applying to graduate school, I thought, okay, what do I want to study and get my degree in and become an expert in? And I thought back to my experiences, and I wanted to know why some students, even within the same school, can go on and seem to have academic success, or what would be considered academic success, and other students at the time seem to be struggling. And there's a lot of answers to that question, some of which right. I learned through more reading in graduate school, and some of which I learned through some of my own research.
But you found that, again, your own experience. You know, if you're coming from an uneven school system, then and there's some kind of racial divide or racial filter that, you know, screens for who's in those school systems, well, maybe that's the answer. But you're saying, no, we all went to the same school. It was all designed to get you into college. And we're seeing vastly different outcomes from these students, and maybe not the same kind of without the same kind of variety in outcomes that we may have seen in white or other students.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even within my school, there were programs. There was the science and tech program. There were gifted and talented classes. There were tracks, essentially. And so even within the same school, you could be kind of positioned right. to do more or less well, depending on the classes you were even allowed to take.
So talk about the kind of research then you did looking at that question.
Yeah, so I didn't particularly look at tracking, but the first project I got involved with when I got to University of Michigan was around this idea of de-identification. So kind of building off the stereotype work. So Claude Steele says that there's this idea of stereotype threat, right? That there's stereotypes that we know exist, right? Girls are less good at math. Black students are going to be less intelligent, unarticulate. These are stereotypes. They're not necessarily or particularly true, but we know they exist. Right. And so the threat of them is enough to diminish performance. Worrying about it, being aware of it is enough. And over time, the continued threat might cause one to separate themselves from academics. So this idea of disidentification, that you preserve your sense of self by dissociating with the academic side of life. So I wanted to see, was that really true? Because in my experience, I grew up around a whole lot of black kids that preserved and loved their sense of self. They loved being black. They had high self-esteem and also were very into academics. that was another strong part of who they were.
And just to put this another way, and let me see if I'm right about this, this is the stereotype that suggests that there is a whole universe, a subset of maybe African-American students who believe that it is white to do well. And so therefore, if I'm going to maintain my black identity, I'm not going to do well in school because that's the white thing to do. And
yeah.
There's a belief out there that that's a widely held view by many African-American students.
Right. So so that's the acting white hypothesis and the assumption that that's a widely held view. Exactly. And so in my research, I said that's not my experience of black students. And so is this a widely held view? And what happened? So I looked at some data about almost 300 black college freshmen. And I said, okay, what's your self-esteem? What were your high school grades? And I looked to see if they kind of fell into groups or profiles. And so there was a group that had high self-esteem and lower grades. And that was the largest group. So we was considered maybe that was disidentified. They're maintaining their self-esteem at the expense of their grades. But there was also the second largest group that had high self-esteem and high grades. And the smaller groups were low self-esteem, low grades, and low grades but high self. No, yeah, low grades but high self-esteem. So all four combinations. But the ones with high self-esteem and high grades also had very strong racial identity. So they believed strongly that blackness was important to who they were and had very positive feelings about being black and being a member of the black community. And so this idea that whiteness is equivalent to achievement was kind of debunked somewhat in my study, at least for this particular group, because for this group, the high self-esteem and high achievement was coupled with very strong positive sense of racial self.
Right. But it does get into deep questions about racial identity, both white and black. If we will just stick with that binary for this conversation, it's a much more diverse conversation nationally. But we're going to talk about this particular binary. That identity will play an important part in your education, how you see yourself as a black student, how you see yourself as a white student, and how your teachers see each of you. Those are still critical questions, right?
Oh, yes, it's definitely, because many things can impact students' racial identity. Particularly, you know, students really start to understand race in early elementary school. You know, they cannot say who they are, who other people are, and really start to digest those stereotypes and messages that parents, teachers, peers will give them. And so as they go through and are developing who they are, teachers matter. The curriculum matters. You know, who do you learn about in school? Who don't you ever learn about? Who do you always learn about negatively? Is the black story always a slave story, right? Do you ever learn about how that history is rich and complex and who's complicit and who's not? You know, what kind of messages do you get at home? All of these things matter over time and through high school. And in college is where we see, you know, that emerging adulthood, 18 to 29 kind of range, where people really kind of more solidify in their identity and who they are and who they want to be.
It seems to me that one of the challenges here is how to cope with that. If you're starting out at a point where your identity hasn't been fully developed, and your own critical judgment about what might be happening or what might not be in the curriculum, all those good questions that you have to ask, you've internalized so much, you're not even asking yourself the question as then the system is telling you who you are and what they think you can achieve.
Yes, yes. And, you know, that's why especially this emerging adulthood area is so critical, because you kind of leave home, leave high school, maybe you're getting employment, maybe you're going to college, maybe you're doing both, maybe you're going to the military, but you're entering a new environment. And so you say, oh, everything that I was particularly taught may or may not necessarily be how the rest of the world works. You're exposed to new reading, new people, new experiences, and you have to kind of reconcile that. And so you can have opportunities where you say, huh, things I was taught in school aren't inherently true about me and people like me. There's another way to be. that perhaps might be more beneficial psychologically, academically, and the like.
So let's talk about what's going on with you at this moment in your career now. We've got you at the University of Michigan, right?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
you're doing your research. How are you liking it? You've made this big career switch.
Yes.
And, you know, you're committed to it. Obviously, you're passionate about the ideas. Were you liking the career? Were you sold on it?
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah. You know, I went to the University of Michigan. I did not want to be in the cold. I was coming from Massachusetts. I said, this is for the birds. It's very cold. I would not like to live in the cold. But Michigan had a program. They invited undergraduate students who looked like they had promising resumes for research to visit. And so I talked to students. I talked to faculty. They gave us some tips and pointers for our application. And there were so many faculty doing tremendous work around Black youth. I said, if I want to study Black youth, I have to be here.
Did they invite you in the summer, by the way? That's usually when they... So what we do here, you know.
It was like raining. Yeah. It was probably the fall. And visiting day was in February, and I still went.
Wow, okay. Because so... that's what they do at Duke and UNC, probably at State, too. They bring you all down from Harvard in February.
Yeah.
And then when you're just about sick to death of the snow, they say, well, we've got a lot of the same things you got there at Harvard, but... you notice the sun is shining and our streets are clear.
Oh, yeah, 70 degrees tomorrow.
They do that trick.
Yeah.
So you're happy there. What's next for you in your mind? Where are you going to go?
In my mind, I had went straight through from undergrad. So in my mind, I wanted to do a postdoc. I wanted to get additional research experience. And then I hoped to have a tenure track position. But also at the time, I graduated undergrad in 2008 at the height of the recession. And so tenure track positions were a little more precarious. A lot of people stayed in their jobs versus retiring. And so my primary goal was to be a professor, to do research, to do mentoring, to do teaching. That was the hope.
Alon Hope got to do just that at the North Carolina State University. And we'll talk more about her career and her research on the state of things when our conversation continues. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking to Alon Hope, went to a rigorous STEM-focused high school. Some of her classmates were doing very well at Ivy League institutions. Others were struggling to hold minimum wage jobs, and she wanted to know why these people who had the same opportunities, went to that same school as she did, were doing so differently. Today, Alon is a professor in the Department of Psychology at North Carolina State University, and we talked about your graduate work at the University of Michigan. Tell me a little bit more about your research there and what you were looking into and what you found.
Yeah, so I got involved in a couple of other projects while I was at Michigan. One through the Center for the Study of Black Youth in Context, and we looked at middle-class Black families. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the research had been focused on Blackness, but synonymous with lower income or poverty. And so my advisors got a large grant to look at middle-class Black families in three different school districts. And so two districts were majority white districts, and one was a majority Black district. And the particular project that I worked on, we did all these interviews with teachers and students and parents, and really wanted to understand the experience of Black middle school students in those districts. And the districts were particularly interesting. They had this thing called school of choice. So that meant that students could, or families could, choose to go to other schools, to apply and go to other schools other than their neighborhood school. Mm-hmm. And so in the majority white districts, there was this assumption that all the Black kids at the school were school of choice students. Mm-hmm. But the assumption wasn't inherently true. And there was also an assumption that if they were school of choice students, they were new. But in some of the districts, you could only start in kindergarten. So the students had been educated in that district for most of their career.
I would be interested to know how the assumption was expressed. In other words, how did we know that was the assumption?
Yeah. The teacher said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They would talk about the students and say, the Black students, their school of choice students. There was kind of this conflation of Blackness and school of choice. And so with one of my advisors, Carla O'Connor, and several other graduate students, we wrote about this issue and this idea of an interloper, someone who's kind of coming in to what is presumed to be not theirs to come into, and what that means in terms of how teachers see Black students. and assumptions they make about what they can do as educators to educate those students. Well, it's nothing I can do. We didn't raise them in this school district. Well, actually, you did. Mm. And how that can limit the educational opportunities of Black students.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the next thing, and the most important part of it would be the next step, and what's the impact on students who are taking this message on and mm-hmm. hearing it every single day.
Yeah, and for students, you know, you kind of have a choice of you either internalize it and go with it, and so maybe you kind of have mediocre grades and you just kind of go along, or you embrace a class clown kind of label, or you push back against it, which is a lot of cognitive work. So in addition to the actual work of school, you're also doing this work to maintain your self-esteem, to maintain your academic goals and rigor, despite messages you might be getting.
And that would be interesting, too, because you're talking about middle-class schools. You're not necessarily talking about STEM or special programs. But this must be inherent and embedded in special programs as well, where students have already been selected. Something about them is, you know, they got through the gauntlet, right?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't miscast and placed in the wrong program, but they're still getting the same message.
Oh, yeah, and that was my experience. And, you know, I remember from the fourth grade, we were all in the talented and gifted program, yet and still there was these divisions that were put upon us and stereotypes that we kind of had to fight against.
How do you work with that? Because it seems to me that you probably have some teachers with some great intentions and who would be surprised to know that this is in fact a bias and it is quite destructive. How do you work with that?
Yeah, you know, I will be the first to say teachers have very challenging and demanding jobs. And one thing that I think can really be important is the training. You know, the longer in life you go without deeply understanding what your role could be and the types of power you have in different positions, teachers, administrators, principals, parents, the harder it is to change.
Are there good training programs out there? It seems to me your research could be the basis of some of that training.
Yeah. So there's definitely anti-racism workshops here in Durham that happen. Some schools send their teachers or, you know, administrators to those trainings. There's a program that I've worked with out in Massachusetts that does excellent summer work. There's a whole summer workshop at the Andover Breadloaf program where teachers come and do specific anti-racism training. So how can I not just be, well, I'm not racist, how can I be anti-racist in my curriculum, in my classroom, in my discipline strategies, and in my teaching?
So that's maybe at the building level or at the individual, the teacher level, along the professional lines. What about systemically? It's a larger system than that, and school systems are part mm-hmm. of a larger system. What kind of changes do you think need to happen to get better outcomes from our schools?
Yeah, some colleagues of mine and I, we've written about this recently, this idea of belonging, right? So when kids belong in schools, they tend to do better. They want to be there, and they tend to have better achievement outcomes. And we've conceptualized belonging as not just how individuals feel with their peers and teachers, but also how belonging is embedded in instructional practices and at the institution level. So who's in your curriculum? How do students feel they belong by what's being taught? And also, how do students feel they belong in the policies? Time and time again, we turn on the news and there's stories of Black students who are thrown out of school because they have braids or dreadlocks or particular cultural phenomena, like their hair that grows out of their head, right? Those are institutional policies that signal to students they don't belong in schools.
How about the curricula, too? It seems to me, a history program, social studies, all of those things, it can be very easy not to see yourself in an American history class.
Yeah, and also particularly how is your group represented, right? As I mentioned earlier, right, this idea of like slave narratives. Yes, slavery is a part of our American history, but how is it taught? How comfortable are teachers teaching it in terms of thinking about white supremacy and how long slavery was and why America was so intent on holding on to treating human beings as if they were property? And what are those implications that still hold true today? You know, teachers have to be very comfortable not just kind of glossing over the basics, but really getting into what that means historically and in contemporary ways.
Yeah, I mean, that does mean not just, you know, sort of getting to 1865 and say, glad that's over with.
Yeah.
You have to talk about the fact that, as you say, this is a foundation, it's fundamental, and it's still the foundation. So white supremacy is at the foundation. You can't make the foundation go away unless you blow it up. So it's still there. That's a hard thing to teach.
Yeah.
White supremacy is still a founding principle of the United States of America. And then the impact. We still have financial structures, financial wealth transfers that go on that are very, very much the result of all of that. So it's, don't just breathe a sigh of relief.
And when students go into classrooms, if they can learn a more rounded history about themselves, then they can take that back and say, this is a group I'm proud to be a part of. These are the achievements of my group as well. We're not limited to just what was acted upon us.
You've also looked at how kids navigate this when they mm-hmm. when they're taking these messages on and they realize they can't do much about it. Talk about that.
Yeah, so also at Michigan, I really got into this idea of critical consciousness. So Paulo Freire's idea that in order to uproot and to change systems of inequality, you have to understand them. And so I started looking at, even as young as middle school, how do Black kids understand systems of inequality? And first was the question, like, do they? And the answer was yes. They don't always have the language to describe it in articulate ways that one might if they've done a whole dissertation on it, but they understand that there's larger systems at play that impact their daily lives. And they also really start to think about what their role could be in dismantling those systems. So talking to seventh graders in the Midwest in the kind of 2010 era, you know, they talked about the recession. They talked about politically corrupt mayors and governors, and they talked about the impact that has on their schooling options, on poverty, on income, jobs. There's still a lot of misinformation, but that's why it's so important.
Well, because it can be, I mean, just what you said, if you're only going to focus on an individual, a corrupt governor and a corrupt mayor, again, you may have missed the system in all of this, why it turns up so many of these and why so much of what they do is not corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfectly legal. That's when it's even scarier, you know.
Yeah.
But so take us to the next step then, because I know this is now something that you're looking at, which is activism among,
yes,
particularly among young people.
Yes. So from that, a big question I had was, if, how, and why do Black youth become activists? This also was at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement. While I was doing my dissertation, Trayvon Martin was shot and killed. While I was doing my postdoc, Mike Brown was shot and killed. And so I really wanted to know what were the impetus and the differences for people who were out protesting and those who maybe weren't protesting but were doing something else, and those who were really disengaged from kind of social change. And a big factor I looked at was also racial identity. So how do you feel about your own group? And how does that impact the kind of change you want to see? And then also, what do you know about systems of inequality? And generally, we find that Black youth who have stronger, more positive sense of who they are in relation to their race tend to be more willing to do kind of low risk things. So they might confront a joke that's not really funny, a racial joke. They might wear a T-shirt. But especially also Black youth who really understand more the systems of inequality are also more willing to do high risk things. So they might protest where they may get arrested. They might do some more risky kind of activism.
You know, on the one hand, that sounds intuitive. The more you know about the system, the more likely you are to engage. On the other hand, if you take a look at the 500-year history of this and you see your position in it and the number of reform movements and the number of times in which change was undertaken and activism was employed, you might come to the other conclusion, sadly. I mean, are you finding there is a way in which, and I don't mean to be cynical, but I'd like to address this. You could say, wait, this system is not going to change. I get it. Oh, do I get it?
Yeah.
And no, I'm not going to engage this.
Yeah, I think there is room for that kind of connection. So far, I haven't found it explicitly in my research, but that is something that I've heard in conversation, right? That this idea of, well, it's not going to change anyway, so why should I act? But I think when you think about and consider all of the different facets, that's also why some people choose one action versus another.
Well, I was going to ask you, too, that the more interesting question to me, having sort of laid that on the table, is in the face of all of that, those who are active, why do they do it? Why are they active in the face of all of that?
Yeah, part of it, I think, is really this idea that perhaps it could change. Another theory I'm kind of beginning to test in some of my new work that we'll do next semester is this idea that it's also a stress relief. So if you have this stress of racism, the interpersonal interactions, the institutions you come in contact with, the broader culture that continually has these different messages every day, maybe doing something, an active kind of coping mechanism, can help release and reduce the stress that you feel as a result. And so we're actually going to test this hypothesis with Black college students and test, okay, on days where you have more experiences of racism on campus, more stress, days later, do you do any more kind of activism? Do you go to an org meeting? Do you help do a particular action or protest? Do you look up information? Do you talk to peers? What do you do in response to these instances?
Yeah, it'd be interesting too. I mean, there's two parts to that. One is, does it have the impact? Does it have the effect of relieving stress? And two, how conscious of that are you? In other words, do you do it precisely for that reason, or do you do it and it turns out it did that? And a great psychology researcher figured that out and came back and told you what happened to you. All great. So we'll have you back with that research. And this is personal to you. You've got two kids, 4 and 6 months.
Yes.
So as you're doing this research, what do you think about it? You've got two kids coming up through the system.
You know, as a Black woman in America, the research is really personal. You know, it is my life. And as I have kids coming into public school soon, I think deeply about what kind of school do I want my 4-year-old to go to next year? And what kind of teachers do I hope are educating him? What curriculum do I hope he's getting in the classroom? It is stressful. But, you know, some days I feel like I know too much.
Well, that's the centerpiece of your research. You're not going to know any less. Talk about this new project called Everyday Race and Stress Experiences.
Yes, the ERACE study, Everyday Race and Stress. So that's what I was just talking about, where basically we're going to look and follow a couple hundred Black college students. And every day they'll do a quick survey about their day. So did you experience any racism in class, in the media? What have you experienced today? What's your stress and mood today? And did you do any activism today? And so far, there's not, to my knowledge, been any study of kind of activism on a day-to-day basis. We usually ask people, what did they do last week, last month, last year? And so I want to see more of that cause and effect that we're talking about. What do you do on any given day? And is that related at all to what has happened in the day before or on that day?
We will have you back when you get those results.
Awesome.
Alon Hope is a professor in the Department of Psychology, North Carolina State. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been awesome.
You can find out more about her research at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter to get a daily preview of our lineup. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.